This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Al Gore is back in the news because of his new movie about global warming called An Inconvenient Truth. He was one of the big attractions at the Cannes Film Festival where the movie was just screened. Now it's opening in American theaters. Reporting from Cannes, New York Times film critic A.O. Scott wrote, "Gore is a surprisingly engaging vehicle for some very disturbing information." Here's an example of disturbing information from Gore's companion book, An Inconvenient Truth. Gore writes, "The voluminous evidence now strongly suggests that unless we act boldly and quickly to deal with the underlying causes of global warming, our world will undergo a string of terrible catastrophes, including more and stronger storms like Hurricane Katrina. We are melting the North Polar ice cap and virtually all of the mountain glaciers in the world. We are destabilizing the massive mound of ice on Greenland and the equally enormous mass of ice propped up on islands in West Antarctica, threatening a worldwide increase in sea levels of as much as 20 feet. Gore's new movie and book are adapted from his multimedia presentation about global warming, which he estimates he's given about 1,000 times to audiences here and in other countries. Al Gore, welcome back to Fresh Air. You know, at the beginning of the movie, you say that you've been trying to tell this story about global warming for a long time and that you feel as if you failed to get the message across. Why was it so difficult as a politician to get the message across?
Well, Terry, I think there are several reasons. First, it's a complex issue. When you boil it all down, it's fairly simple, but it does have a lot of moving parts, and the complexity by itself is an obstacle. Secondly, there's a natural tendency to avoid thinking about subjects that might involve some psychic pain and the idea that human civilization is colliding with the Earth's environment is a painful reality. And third, it's a new reality. Nothing in our history or culture prepares us for the new reality, the new relationship between human civilization and the planet's ecosystem. We've quadrupled our population globally in the last 100 years, and we've magnified the power of our technologies thousands of times over. And when you combine those two elements, 6.5 billion people times incredibly powerful ways of exploiting nature, and then you mix in a new philosophy of discounting the future consequences of present actions, it produces this new collision, that the most dangerous part of which is global warming. And so it's hard to absorb it, but I think it is now beginning to sink in. I think people are coming to grips with it, and I'm actually becoming optimistic that we're going to respond in time.
Over the years, when you were in politics, you were sometimes mocked for your environmental positions. George H.W. Bush called you Ozone Man and said if the Clinton-Gore ticket won, we'll be up to our neck in owls and out of work. Are there other ways that you think the issue was spun over the years to make environmentalists and people who are interested in reversing the effects of global warming seem like kooks?
Sure. And that's another reason that it has been difficult to communicate the truth, the inconvenient truth, if you will, about this planetary emergency. And that is that some interests, political, business, and otherwise, and ideological, strongly resist the truth here, have used every means at their disposal to confuse people, to put out misinformation, much in the way the tobacco industry tried to confuse people about the scientific linkage after the Surgeon General's report in 1964 showing that smoking cigarettes causes lung disease. They were able to confuse people about the validity of that science and continue the pattern of abuse for almost 4 decades. And basically the same thing has been going on now. And the disinformation, the ridicule, the intentional confusion, all that's part of a political strategy.
Well, how much of your how much of the anti-environmentalism and the resistance to moving against global warming, how much of that do you think is coming from, for instance, the oil-related industry that has a vested interest in keeping a certain status quo? And how much of it do you think is coming from people who don't believe the science or who don't get the science?
Well, I think they go together. It comes from both sources. And there, I would add in a third source. There is there's a concern on the part of some ideological conservatives that some on the progressive side have engaged in hyperbole over the years, over the decades, in trying to stampede the people in the Congress to enact some new regulatory initiative by exaggerating the seriousness of this or that crisis that we have faced. And it's a boy cried wolf story in that respect. I think some of them are genuinely suspicious of any description of an impending catastrophe. And I understand that. This is different, and I think some of them are now awakening to it. But as for the first two causes, I think that any change is inconvenient, and the prospect of making a transition in the technologies we use and some of the patterns we follow in our lives, that's something that people don't like to think about. But at the core of it, there are millions of dollars being spent every year by a small group led by ExxonMobil and a few other companies that support pseudoscientists that almost never publish in any peer-reviewed journal, but put out disinformation and in the process try to confuse, first of all, the news media into thinking that they are obligated to say the majority feel the Earth is round, but some feel it's flat. And really, the consensus on global warming is as strong as it gets in science, and the naysayers are so isolated and so without any support or respect in the mainstream science community. It is partly the oil company disinformation campaign that keeps their message out there.
Let me mention a study that you cite in your documentary and in your book, An Inconvenient Truth. And this is a study from the University of California at San Diego. A scientist there named Dr. Naomi Oreskes published in Science Magazine a study of every peer-reviewed journal article on global warming from the previous 10 years. And in her random sample of 928 articles, she found that no articles disagreed with the scientific consensus on global warming. Then another study of articles on global warming that were published in the previous 14 years in the press, specifically published in the New York Times, Washington Post, LA Times, and Wall Street Journal, found that more than half of those stories gave equal weight to the scientific consensus and to the view that human beings played no role in global warming. So just to sum up, the scientific journals, the scientists agreed about global warming, but in these four, you know, major American newspapers, equal weight was given in half the articles to the opposing view that human beings are not causing global warming. So what does that say to you? How do you interpret that?
Well, it's astonishing. And that image in the movie and in the slideshow that has preceded the movie is probably the one slide that has evoked more post-presentation commentary when people come up afterwards and ask questions than any other. And it does highlight the gulf between science and popular culture. C.P. Snow wrote years ago about the two cultures. I guess that gap is even wider now, but I think it illustrates something else in this instance. It illustrates the vulnerability of our marketplace of ideas, our public conversation, if you will, to manipulation by the kinds of techniques that were innovated early in the 20th century and were labeled propaganda. They're more sophisticated now. They're part of corporate PR strategies. They have been refined. And the nature of the news media has also changed, not in all media, but in a lot. And as a result, I think we're more vulnerable to this kind of manipulation. I think we've seen it in other areas as well. Before the vote on the Iraq War, 77% of the American people genuinely believed that it was Saddam Hussein who was responsible for hijacking the planes and flying them into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon and in Pennsylvania. And there have been times in our past when we've been vulnerable to being misled over an extended period, but not like now. And when there's a very well-funded, determined, unethical corporate campaign of disinformation, it can have a much larger impact on the impressions put into the minds of the American people than is healthy in a democracy.
When you were running for the presidency in 2000, did your advisors warn you against talking about global warming in your campaign?
Well, you know, some have written that that took place. My view of that is slightly different. It wasn't a warning. It was their feeling that every single news cycle every day should be focused on whatever issue would get the most traction, if you will, the most response, and move the needle on in the horse race of the election. And in spite of that, I insisted on continuing to address this issue. But I have to say that in one respect, they were tactically correct, because often when I would discuss the issue, the formal presentation would be completely ignored in favor of some response during a Q&A afterwards on whatever the horse race issue of the day was. And over time, that inevitably led to them saying, well, look, you know, we tried this, we tried that, and that's ignored. And remember, this was at a time when, more than half of all the news articles were saying this issue may not even be real, and B, my opponent, then Governor Bush, had publicly pledged to regulate CO2, and therefore the perception, I mean, a pledge that was broken immediately after the inauguration, but the perception during the contest itself was that there wasn't that much contrast. Here was a so-called compassionate conservative who said he cared a lot about global warming and had pledged to legally force the reductions of greenhouse gases, and therefore why would that be a fit issue for covering the campaign conflict? So to that extent, it was difficult to have a full-blown contrast presented in the press.
I guess I'm wondering if you've lost faith in the political system when it comes to global warming, if you think that there are certain issues like global warming that just have no sticking power in the political world until years and years and years later. Because you were talking earlier about how it was a very difficult issue to communicate during the 2000 election. Now you're going back to the very beginning of your political career and talking about how difficult it was to communicate that issue then, even when you had, you know, a leading scientific expert talking about it. So is politics a bad arena to talk about an issue like this?
It's a tough arena. I haven't lost faith, though, because I believe, and from my experience, I feel as if I know that the political system shares one thing in common with the climate system. It's nonlinear. It can appear to move at a glacier's pace, and then after crossing a tipping point, it can suddenly move rapidly into a completely new pattern. I've seen that happen. And when enough people absorb this message and understand it and feel the sense of urgency that it demands, they will in turn demand that politicians in both parties react accordingly. And I think that there will come a time when our political system does cross a tipping point. And in that sense, I still have faith that we will respond. It's just taken 30 years longer than I thought it would.
Let me ask you another question in comparing politics and your political career with the case you make for global warming in your movie An Inconvenient Truth. In your political career, you were criticized often for, you know, rightly or wrongly, for being stiff, for not being as communicative and as lively as you might have been. Your reviews for this movie, the ones I've seen, largely have been very positive, both in terms of the larger issues that you talk about, but also in terms of your presentation. You've been praised for being lively and funny and engaging, a different evaluation of you than you typically got, for instance, in your 2000 campaign. So what do you think has changed?
Well, I benefit from low expectations. but I think that there are two reasons for the comments that you're referring to. Number one, I think that in a political campaign, particularly a campaign for president, the way a candidate's perceived is shaped by the constant attacks by the opposing side, shaped by the healthy skepticism that viewers and listeners bring to anything that somebody asking for votes is saying, and shaped also by the necessities of a campaign, which really don't allow you to speak about only one issue, but require you to necessarily speak about the full range of concerns that the American voters have a right to hear your views on. And when you move from one to the other, that's a different kind of presentation. But I think there's a second reason for the comments you mentioned, and that is I have been through a lot in the last 6 years. And the old cliche that what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, I think is sometimes true. And all of us learn and grow and evolve in our lives. And, you know, your interviews are... I'm sure you've got a lot of listeners who contrast the interviews you do now with ones you did when you first started, and find new texture and depth, and that's part of just living our lives.
You've traveled around different parts of the world looking at the symptoms of global warming. What's the most disturbing thing that you've seen in those travels?
The melting of the North Pole is one of the most urgent catastrophes that should be prevented as quickly as we can convince people to act. It's a fairly thin floating ice cap, and as you know, the Arctic and the Antarctic are very different. The Arctic is ocean surrounded by land, while the Antarctic is land surrounded by ocean, and that makes all the difference in the thickness of the ice. It's 10,000 feet thick in the Antarctic and less than 10 feet thick in the Arctic, much less now. We've lost 40% of it in the last 40 years. And when the ice there melts, there's a dramatic change in the relationship of the surface of the Earth there to the sun. The ice reflects 90% of the incoming sun's energy like a mirror, but the open seawater, after it melts, absorbs 90%, and that's a phase change. It sets up a positive feedback loop that magnifies and speeds up the melting process. And the North Polar ice cap is in grave danger now, and nearby, the great ice mound of Greenland is under increasing pressure from growing temperatures also. If that were to melt, it would, or to break up and slip into the sea, it would raise sea level 20 feet worldwide. The West Antarctic ice shelf that on the other end of the planet, at the other pole, is the part of Antarctica propped up against islands that allow it to be affected by the warming ocean, but also allow it to raise sea level by 20 feet again if it melts or breaks up and slides into the ocean. And these are the three areas that many scientists point to as affecting a so-called point of no return, which we need to avoid, because if we cross that point of no return, then the process of a downward spiral would be irretrievable. So we have to stop short of that.
I'd like your evaluation of the Bush White House on global warming.
Well, it's a great disappointment. And I must say I'm not completely surprised, because I did more or less expect it. But the brazenness of it is surprising. To take the chief propagandist in charge of the disinformation campaign funded by ExxonMobil and a few other irresponsible companies, and make that person the person in charge of all White House environmental policy, and to take that person who has no scientific training whatsoever and empower him to censor the scientific reports that were intended by the EPA and other groups of scientists for the American people, and to censor them to conform to the economic desires of the biggest polluters in the country, I think that should shock people. I really do. And maybe we have grown numb to these kinds of manipulations by special interests, but almost every key position in that affects environmental policy has been filled by the Bush-Cheney administration with spokespersons, propagandists, lobbyists for the polluters. And the fact that there has not been more outrage about that speaks volumes about the desiccation of the public forum in which these kinds of abuses once were called to task, and now they're just not.
The person who you were referring to, who was the head of the who Bush appointed to head environmental policy, was Philip Cooney, who had been a lawyer lobbyist with the American Petroleum Institute.
Right, and before that, he defended Exxon in the Exxon Valdez oil spill case, and then he was in charge of that disinformation campaign. Yes.
You've referred to organized campaigns to, you know, discredit the science of global warming. Can you point to one that you think of as an organized campaign to discredit the science of global warming?
Well, there's one running on television right now. One of the many front groups that's funded by these polluters, the Competitive Enterprise Institute, is running television ads right now. And the tagline is, the announcer says, CO2. They call it pollution. We call it life. It almost falls of its own absurdity, but over 20 years, I have seen them have a tremendous effect. There was a large investigative piece in Mother Jones magazine showing how ExxonMobil, just one company, has financed in whole or in part 40 different organizations and front groups that exist for the purpose of putting out disinformation on global warming, I think it'll be looked back upon as immoral, and I mean I see it. I think it's horribly unethical and immoral, and just as some of the tobacco executives now look back on their efforts in the 70s and 80s and feel shame, I'm certain the day will come when some of these executives will feel shame about what they're doing, because they have slowed down the ability of our democracy to absorb the truth of our circumstances. We face a planetary emergency. It's a challenge to our moral imagination to realize the gravity of this. The future of our civilization is at risk. And that sounds shrill, and it sounds outside the boundaries of our shared experience, and so many distrust such a formulation, but it's the truth. And we have to absorb it. And then we have to organize a very bold, urgent, effective response. We are, after all, one of only two countries in the entire advanced world that has not already joined the World Treaty to fight against global warming. And since we're the largest economy, it's important that we rectify that.
You were recently on Saturday Night Live. I'm sure a lot of our listeners saw this. And you were on as the president in a parallel universe, in a parallel universe where you were actually the 43rd president, and you were delivering a speech from the Oval Office about how we've reversed global warming, how we're dealing with our huge budget surplus, and how much the rest of the world loves America. In fact, let me just play a little clip from Saturday Night Live. This is Al Gore.
In the last 6 years, we have been able to stop global warming. No one could have predicted the negative results of this. Glaciers that once were melting are now on the attack. As you know, these renegade glaciers have already captured parts of Upper Michigan and Northern Maine, but I assure you, we will not let the glaciers win. Right now, in the second week of May 2006, we are facing perhaps the worst gas crisis in history. We have way too much gasoline. Gas is down to 19 cents a gallon, and the oil companies are hurting. I know that I am partly to blame by insisting that cars run on trash. I am therefore proposing a federal bailout to our oil companies because, hey, if it were the other way around, you know the oil companies would help us.
As Al Gore recently on Saturday Night Live, Al Gore, do you sometimes play the what-if game? And do you sometimes play the game of how the world might have been different if you had become president in 2000?
Only in an alternate universe.
But seriously, do you think about that a lot? Do you play that game?
No, I don't. and if you were in my situation, I doubt you would either. It's just a lot healthier to look forward and try to focus on the positive things that lie ahead. And you know, it was a difficult experience, but not so much for me as it was for the millions of people who were negatively affected by the policies that had been put in place because of that election. But I made a choice to uphold the rule of law after the Supreme Court decision. In our system, there's no intermediate step between a final Supreme Court decision and violent revolution. And so I made a decision to support the rule of law and then to go on with my life and try to find ways to live a positive and useful life. And I'm pleased to have been able to find ways to serve in other ways. And I'm enjoying them. I've started a couple of businesses that are quite fulfilling for me, teaching some, serving on the board of Apple and advising Google. But most of my time is spent delivering my slideshow and speaking on the climate crisis. And it's an increasing part of my time.
Is there any chance that you would run for the presidency again?
I don't see any chance. I'm not thinking about that, not planning it, don't expect it. I have said when pressed on this question, as I'm sure you're about to press me, that I haven't reached a point in my life where I'm willing to say never again will I ever consider such a thing for the rest of my life. But that is more a function of internal gear shifting, not an effort to be coy and put a keep the door open to it.
You got to see George W. Bush close up when he was your opponent for the presidency. What surprises you most about how the Bush presidency has turned out?
I guess what surprises me most is his incuriosity. That's a real mystery to me because he's clearly a smart man. He has a different kind of intelligence, as everybody does. There's so many varieties of intelligence. He's clearly a smart man. But it is a puzzle that he would ask no questions about important matters. When his first Secretary of the Treasury came in for their first meeting and spoke for an hour about the economic policies of the new administration, he asked not a single question. When he received the briefing about in August of 2001 that Osama bin Laden was planning a major attack soon on the United States. He did not ask a single question when he was briefed before several days before the Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, and the Weather Service people were saying it may be mark a return to medieval conditions. He asked not a single question. And that same incuriosity seems to be a factor when he just accepts hook, line, and sinker the ExxonMobil view that global warming is not a problem, in no way related to the massive volumes of pollution we're putting into the Earth's atmosphere every hour of every day. When they tell him that the scientific community is wrong and that they're just lying because they're greedy for more research dollars, he doesn't apparently look under the rug. He doesn't ask questions. And in the American system, the President of the United States is the only person who is charged with representing all of the people in every state and every district and looking after the welfare of the people as a whole. And if a special interest has one view, at least you should ask questions about how the public interest is affected. And I really do not know why he is so incurious.
Does Congress look different to you from a distance? And, you know, so many Congress watchers are saying it's more divided than they can ever remember it being in their memories. Does it appear that way to you, too? And what are some of the differences you see?
Well, I served in the Congress for a long time, and for 18 years, and then as president of the Senate. And it was a different Congress than what we have today. The legislative branch of government is intended to be co-equal with the executive and judicial and independent. And as such, it's supposed to conduct oversight and render independent judgments of policy. And this Congress has been so shockingly obsequious to the desires of the president and his political advisors that it has become a rubber stamp. This Congress has actually, if you look at their plans and schedule, they will work 17 days less in this Congress than the legendary do-nothing Congress that Harry Truman ran against in his last race. They allow lobbyists to write the laws. They ignore the parliamentary rules of procedure. They allow the executive branch and the lobbyists that work there to come in at the tail end of the legislative process after the conference committees have met and insert special interest language that neither House of Congress has ever considered, much less voted on independently. And that results in powerful and wealthy special interests writing laws that the rest of us have to abide by under penalty of imprisonment or whatever the penalty in the individual law is. And that is something the Congress has allowed to happen. And I do not think that many of them are simply not living up to their oath to defend the Constitution.
Democrats and Republicans?
Well, I'm afraid that, first of all, the Democrats, were they in power, would not have allowed this to happen. Have some of them been too willing to go along and too willing to allow some of these things to happen? Yes, I'm afraid that is the case. But I'm not going to blame the victims, because I do believe that if they were in power, it would be very different. And I have great hopes that the elections this fall, the 2006 midterm elections, will produce a real tidal wave of change. I certainly hope they will.
Does it ever amaze you how much the world has changed since you ran for presidency? September 11th, the war in Iraq,
yeah.
The death
yeah.
that we have, Hurricane Katrina, I mean, on every front, things have changed so much. Did you imagine that that much change would even be possible?
No, no. I did not. And I'm not alone in that. You know, the premise of that Saturday Night Live skit was the existence of an alternate universe. And there are people who sort of voluntarily say, now it feels as if we've entered an alternate universe. I would not have imagined, for example, that Americans could be routinely torturing helpless captives in the name of the American people, and to continue it day after day. It's going on right now without an ongoing outrage and a demand that it stop. I would not have imagined that the government could routinely eavesdrop on tens of millions of Americans without a warrant and not have an ongoing outrage. I would not have imagined that we, the American people, would tolerate the locking up by the executive branch of American citizens without right to trial, without right to inform their families, to be held in secret without being charged. These are offenses against the Constitution and the rule of law that I would never have imagined could take place, much less be allowed to continue after they were, came to light. So, yeah, the degree of change is truly shocking to me.
Al Gore, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Al Gore's new film and book are called An Inconvenient Truth. You can find a link to the film's website on our website, freshair.npr.org.